just one of those wishes comes true, I'll be a very, very happy boy. Okay, but what I can tell you is that, well, we've at least sort of opened up a new direction in terms of thinking about the cosmology of Protestant problem. And in particular, we feel we've made some progress in one particular manifestation of being a
Protestant. Sorry, excuse the interruption. Could you please bring your mic up?
Is that on?
So we feel like we've made some progress in one particular manifestation of the problem, namely that the cleanest one, the one that you understand best, which is where you treat gravity as completely classical, and you look at matter loops calculated in Minkowski space, and then just ask what the vacuum energy corrections coming from those are, and then minimally couple them to gravity and ask what impact they have on the space-time. That's the cleanest and the only sort of manifestation of the cosmological constant problem that you really even begin to understand. And that's the one that, at least with our new mechanism, we feel that we've been able to make progress on. We can eat up those contributions. We can screen them from the gravitational field. And the philosophy is really the following. The vacuum energy, the cosmological constant, you can think of, in a sense, as being like the global components of the energy momentum tensor. So if this is the thing that's annoying you, if this is the thing you're trying to swallow up somehow, then perhaps if you want to do it by some sort of modification of gravity, blah, 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 then perhaps that modification of gravity should be a global one. And this is kind of cute, in a sense, when you think of all these arguments which talk about the uniqueness of general relativity as the unique theory of an interacting massless spin two particle. That's all true locally, but then up to adding maybe some global constraints to the theory. So it respects that as well. And we certainly won't have to jump through hoops to satisfy sort of local gravity constraints in the solar system, for example. Because locally, the theory is going to be identical to general relativity. The modification is going to be global, but that cuts straight to the core of the problem that you're interested in. Okay, so this is work that I've been doing in collaboration with Nemanja Kalapa over a couple of years now. And we've written three papers on the subject. This is a review of the cosmological constant. Everybody feels the need to write one at some point, right? This is mine. Okay. So there'll be more papers in the pipeline. So let me begin by describing what the cosmological constant problem is. Now, everybody has their own preferred way that they like to describe the cosmological constant problem. And when you deviate from that, people get upset. But let me just describe what I think it is. Okay. It's hard. That's what it is, I think. Most people wouldn't argue with that point. But let's go through some of the details. Well, essentially, within the context of general relativity, you have two sort of real, important principles that are living in there. The principle of general covariance and the equivalence principle. Okay. Now, quantum field theory tells you that you have a vacuum energy. Okay. And general covariance and the equivalence principle tell you that it gravitates, and they also tell you how it gravitates, in principle at least. Okay? It comes in with this covariant measure. And that covariant measure contributes to the energy momentum tensor. But of course, this isn't quite what gravitates, because you can always add a bare cosmological constant to the action. And it's really this combination of the sort of the QFT contribution and this bare contribution that gravitates. And observations tell you that combined contribution shouldn't exceed the dark energy scale. So this is the sort of standard story. Okay, then you have the sort of, you can ask, well, how much is this vacuum energy? So again, let me emphasize how I'm going to calculate this here. I'm going to go to a locally Minkowski frame. I'm going to calculate what the vacuum energy contributions are in Minkowski space, and then I'm just going to minimally couple it. That's the idea. This is the standard picture. Okay, so you can think of this as like, each particle, and it's different modes, each contributing a zero point energy. And then you quickly see that you get each particle contributing its mass to the fourth to the vacuum energy. That's kind of the babyish way to do it. You can be a bit more sophisticated and think about loops. Of course, it's the same thing really at the end of the day. And here, for example, you can consider, say, a particle of a scalar of mass m connected to the tadpole diagram connected to external graviton. And you can calculate what that diagram gives you. And of course, this is the only diagram you have to calculate. You don't have to calculate the one with five external gravitons because general covariance tells you it's all going to appear in a root g. But you can do the calculation quite straightforwardly. And if you do dimreg, you'll see why I'm laboring this in a minute. If you do dimreg, you see you get something that goes like the mass of that scalar particle to the fourth. You get a divergent contribution, and you get your finite contributions, and your bit that depends on the regularization scale. Okay, so that's what you get, and of course, so let me emphasize about what the problem isn't. The problem isn't why is the cosmological constant so small. The problem isn't why isn't the cosmological constant Planckian. None of that is really what the problem is. And let me emphasize that. The problem really is, the thing about the cosmological constant is it's the coefficient of an operator which is dimension less than 4. That's not something that you should be able to predict in quantum field theory. It's not something you should expect to predict. Any coupling of an operator which is dimension less than 4, you shouldn't be able to predict. What you should hope to do is to measure it. And when you make that measurement, it should be stable against radiative corrections. Okay? You consider some loop correction, you shouldn't have to redo the measurement. It should be stable. Okay?
So fine.
I have to calculate what the counter term I have to include. I'll show you. Maybe that's the best way. But the idea is I have to calculate what the counter term is that I have to introduce based on the measurement. And then I shouldn't have to radically when I consider further loop corrections, for example, I shouldn't have to radically change what that counter term is. Well, in a sense, not really, because what you're really doing is here, you're tuning a low energy parameter in your theory. But you shouldn't have to redo it when, for example, you're changing your sensitivities to UV physics. That's just effective field theory.
No, that's a naturalness.
Well, of course it's a natural question. This is exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Effective field theory doesn't have a naturalness.
So,
it's an added...
Right. Okay, well, I'm not going to dispute that the cosmological constant problem is a question about naturalness. Of course it is. But this is... We like naturalness, right? Naturalness is a good thing. We like naturalness?
I thought that naturalness was somewhat fake to get the
idea.
Stop talking about it.
Okay. Well, if you're not a lover of naturalness, then there's no real need to worry about the cosmological constant problem, let's say. But I like it, so I'm gonna worry about it.
We always have to do some tuning. It's not power like in the cutoff, it may be logarithmic. Which
sure, absolutely. So this is what you exactly
we can live with that.
Yes. And it's this power like one that we don't like. Okay? But if you can protect yourselves from those further loop corrections, or equivalently from moving the cutoff, that once you've tuned once, and you do that measurement, and it's all fine. That if that's robust against any change in your effective description, then I think that's a satisfactory statement of affairs. And in a sense, it should be what you expect. You should never have expected to be able to predict this thing. Because it's a coupling of an operator which is dimension less than 4. You can't predict that in
there. Well, it depends. You have a theory like string theory with landscape or vacuum. Then you may turn it to a robust.
Okay.
It's a question, what vacuum like? So if you really know the theory...
You have to know everything, right. Yes.
But
so, absolutely.
You don't extend that, but you really have a chance to turn it...
But if I'm going to play with effective field theory, and I simply can't know what all those higher dimensional operators are doing, I just can't do that calculation.
Right. You can say something more modest. Nobody in history has ever done so.
Sorry?
Nobody in history has ever predicted the coefficient of a dimension less than 4 operator.
You can't predict.
It's never been done. Maybe somebody has some
fantasy.
Well, somebody has some fantasy that they could do it in the future, but historically it's never been done.
Well, that's their fantasy. I think it's just...
We agree. Yeah. That sounds very close-minded to say that something can never be done.
Well, not without full knowledge of the theory. Not without complete knowledge of the theory.
Well, but that's what you're striving for.
I would write. I would love to see the next slide.
So. since you asked so kindly, let's go.
You're on time. Right? It's 9:78, so you need to get there.
Yeah, I haven't really got 78 slides. Don't worry about that. Okay, so I knew it would happen. This is what happens every time. Everybody has their own view of what this problem is, and of course, I'll tell you what mine is. Okay, so, I've kind of said all this now. So it's not really the question of why the cosmological constant is so small. This is the normal picture that you see of the different scales that crop up in the theory and the amount of fine-tuning that you think you have to do to match those to observation. But you've seen this before. Okay, so let's come back to that point again. We kind of already discussed this, but let me just repeat it. So again, you calculate this contribution. You have this divergent contribution that, you know, standard renormalization. You add a counter term to eat it up. Yeah, it's some regularization scale, yeah. Yes. Yeah, so that's the regular, the mass scale I would introduce when I do dim reg.
You mean mu?
Yeah, mu. There's a reason I don't call it mu, because mu appears later in it. Yes. What you normally call mu. Yeah. Okay. So you add a counter term. Now you're out. This is the point we come back to. This counter term depends on an arbitrary subtraction scale, which is curly M there. Okay. And then the combined answer, the renormalized vacuum energy, of course, depends on this. It's finite now, but it depends on this arbitrary subtraction scale. And therein lies the point that you cannot predict what it is. It's something that you should just measure. Sure.
But that same thing is true for electron pipes.
Right, yeah, but this is because I've done dim reg. I mean, if I was doing it.
Then you shouldn't be doing this.
Right, just for illustrative purposes. But
well,
yeah.
It doesn't demonstrate the point, that's what I'm
saying. No, it does.
It's the arbitrariness, though.
Little m is a mass in this case.
Yeah.
Capital M is the normalization point. Everything in the world, in any calculation,
is
absolutely the normalization point.
The point I'm trying to emphasize here, Gregory, is the arbitrariness here.
No, but
I agree that the contribution from all massive particles.
Okay, so that arbitrariness, what I'm saying, is true for any single calculation that you do in the standard model.
The problem is the things that you ignore in the
power corrections.
So you could, for couplings of high dimensional operators, you could shoot this higher and then you could be predicted. It's the dimension less than four guys that you can't predict because of this arbitrariness. Now, the key point is that you, is what happens when you consider further loop corrections. Does this get spoiled? And you keep having to retune. That's what I am emphasizing now. But the bottom line is, what I want to emphasize is that it doesn't really matter how big, how small the cosmological constant is. You just go out and measure it, okay? The question is that when you make that measurement, is it robust against any change in your effective description? Because that's naturalness.
Well, the measurement is measurement. Doesn't care about description,
right? No, sure, right, okay. But if I want to have a theory which is describing nature reliably, I don't want to have to keep retuning it when you go to two loops and I go to three loops or whatever.
You measure something, right? So then you calculate and you want to compare your calculation to the measurement. So in QCD, on a daily basis, people do all those measurements and calculations, let's say, and they all have normalization point in the total body calculation, scheme dependent, all that stuff. That gets determined from experiment.
Yes.
Once
yes.
Determined, then you predict something else. Mm-hmm. Right? That's conventional field theory. Has nothing to do with, you know.
But I don't want to receive large corrections when aren't seeing large corrections when I consider high loops.
Power versus logs, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Power, that's the only distinction that exists over there. Because any mass in standard model has log normalization, then most.
Okay, so I've got a mass of the four here, right?
But that mass was your particle.
Okay,
mass,
do a little Sheridan description.
No, but it means threshold correction. Just
threshold corrections exist in a standard model.
That's
you
right.
Measure them.
Yeah.
But let's start
taking M to be what you would call the cutoff.
Right. Well,
yes.
but the reason why we insisted on dim reg and threw away those cutoffs.
No,
you don't.
No,
you throw away.
We still have to do proper matching.
Logarithmic, the power by the vertices, but you don't throw away power like. Threshold corrections.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
If you suppose you discover tomorrow a particle that is a million TeV, then you'll get a correction million TeV to the fourth from the threshold. Yes.
That's
right. The threshold for marginal operators instead does not go like a power of the mass. It goes like some finite number, right? So it's small. You have small thresholds for, say, E versus large thresholds for the cosmological constant. Again, I don't see a
big difference. Because we're using different terminology or something. So in a supersymmetric theory, so if I went, let's say, below God scale or above God scale, there's a threshold correction because of the fact that below God scale I ignore those massive particles and above God scale I match them.
It's a number. It's not mass to the fourth, it's a number. For the coupling constant, it is a number, so it's 1, 3, pi, I don't know. In the corrections, the threshold corrections that you get for a dimension full quantity, of course, by dimensional analysis, has to scale typically like the biggest mass that you integrate out. So it's a big correction. Again, the philosophy of renormalization is always the same. You know the experimental data, and you fix the bare constants knowing the experimental data. Absolutely. You have to redo it loop by loop. Tough luck. I don't see this point of naturalness.
But the point is log.
Well, that's naturalness, whether you're worried about the loop by loop issue or not. That's the question of naturalness. Yeah. But I think we agree on what the question of naturalness is. The question is whether you're worried about it. Yeah. Okay. But the bottom line is it's not something you should expect to be able to predict. So you just measure it. Okay. So how do you measure it? How do you measure the cosmological constant? You go global. It's the only way. Okay, it's the only thing. So can you measure the cosmological constant in this room? No. Okay, because you don't know the thing that you're measuring in this room doesn't change when you go outside of this room. Can you measure it in a day? No, because you don't know that it's not going to change in the future. The only way to generally zoom in on the cosmological constant, the true bona fide zero-point vacuum energy, is to literally scan the whole of space and time. Now, that might not be particularly practical, but philosophically, that's what you would have to do.
But that's not what we care about, right? We care about observables, which are.
And what we care about the rates of correction to that, which will also rates to correct any local potential as well. That's what I really care about.
That's cool, kids.
Okay. So anyway, so what is the true problem? Well, we kind of discussed this. Here now, it's the question of rates of stability. The fact that you, you do your calculation, you do your one loop calculation, and then you then realize that you have to tune the bare parameter, the counter term that you introduced to great precision, but that's okay to match observation. But then when you do the next loop correction, you realize that you have to retune, and you do the next loop correction, you have to retune, blah, blah, blah. It's the whole question of naturalness, isn't it? And this is not natural, the scenario that we find here. Okay? So that's the problem, this issue of radiative instability. So what you really want to do is find a way to make the cosmological constant radiatively stable. And that's not easy, okay? It's notoriously tricky. Of course, supersymmetry would do it, but it has to be down at the MeV scale, little MeV. And it's not, so we know it's broken. So we take a slightly different philosophy here. We ask not why the rated corrections are so small, but why they hardly gravitate. Now, of course, we're not the first people to think of this. And of course, the problem with this is it's generally affected by a no-go theorem. Okay, so you can take the philosophy that, fine, I have all these loop corrections to the cosmological constant. I have no control over them in a sense, but for some reason, gravity doesn't see them. You know, some reason gravity readjusts itself so it doesn't see them. Now, of course, Weinberg had his famous no-go theorem, which says, well, actually, you know, if you have some self-adjustment mechanism with some local fields, you can't do it. This doesn't work. So any theorem, any model which claims to be able to get, you know, to eat up the cosmological constant in this way needs to find a way around Weinberg's theorem. Okay, so what have we proposed? Well, we've proposed what we call the sequester, an Amanuerism, that is. He comes up with these words, but whatever. Okay, so what is the sequester? Well, again, we go global. So we've identified various things about the cosmological constant. It's in a sense the global component of the energy momentum tensor. To measure it, we really have to look at the whole of space-time. It's the global element. So let's modify gravity at that level, which has the added bonus that it means that locally we're going to be identical to general relativity. So this is the action, well, this is almost the action for the sequester. Okay, so of course this is, you'll all recognize this, is just the action for general relativity, minimally coupled to some matter fields, which are big psi. Okay, and I've got some bare cosmological constant here. Now I know, of course, this isn't going to eat up the loops. So I look at this and I know I'm getting these annoying vacuum energy contributions from the matter Lagrangian there. And I have to repeatedly fine tune this parameter here to eat them up. What I'd like to do is make that process dynamical. So the first thing I do is I promote this guy. I free it up slightly. I free it up by making it a dynamical variable. But it's not a variable that is dependent on space and time. It's global. It's constant in space and time, but I'm allowing it to vary, at least in principle, the level of the action. Okay. So it's a global dynamical variable, which I'm now going to vary over in the action. Of course, if that is all I had, I'd get something nonsensical. I would get that the constraint of the volume of the space-time vanished, which, of course, is nonsensical. But I'm going to add a few more ingredients. I need to know something about the matter sector as well. So I'm going to introduce another global dynamical variable which knows about the matter sector, which knows about the mass scales in the matter sector. Okay, which I'm going to call little lambda. Again, little lambda is not space-time dependent. It's constant in space and time, but I'm going to consider it a variable that I can vary over in the action. What this little lambda does is it basically just rescales all the masses in the matter Lagrangian. You can see that straightforward. You can see really if you acknowledge that root g there, put that with that lambda to the fourth, you can really see that these matter fields are coupling to lambda squared g mu nu down. Okay, so it's really just a constant rescaling of the metric that matter couples to.
You also add them to the matter field according to
their dimension? Yeah, so all I'm doing is I'm coupling matter, rather than coupling it to g, I'm coupling it to lambda squared times g. So it's just a constant rescaling of the matter sector.
So you're not rescaling the matter fields.
No, it's just the masses have just now become sensitive to lambda, essentially. In fact, there you see it, right?
If I still get your g so that it's not there, then Einstein-Hilbert gets it.
Yes.
How does it look like?
You mean you want to go to like some Jordan frame, like, you know, it's not,
well, it's really not Jordan, that. Because it's a constant, right?
Yeah, yeah. What you might call that, yes.
Positive power or negative?
You would get a lambda squared underneath here. And actually, it's interesting, that gives you a constraint that the space-time average of the Ricci scalar is zero. Which is kind of key to the mechanism, actually. But that's... But the reason I like looking at it like this is you really see something nice about the fact that all matter couples to lambda squared g, okay? That's a universality of the coupling, means that no matter how many matter loops you introduce, they're always going to scale with lambda in the same way. Okay, so there's a kind of cuteness now. That's going to be important. That means you can cancel one loop through the lambdas talking to one another. You're going to be able to do it two loops, three loops, and so on.
So, but global dynamical variable, you mean that, well, just that constant that the path integral is supposed to integrate over it?
Yeah, so it's actually in the path integral, it'll be like more like an ordinary high school integral.
So, if you do that integral, it's more or less equivalent to writing the path integral, not e to the is, but e to the f of s, right? If I do that integral.
So normally you'd have a function in the path integral, you'd have functional integration over the local fields, right? But now you've just got you could have an ordinary integration as well over, say, these guys.
Yeah, so I can take that integral and then it would be integral over normal fields, but in the exponent it would be not e to the is, but some nonlinear function of s. So
you're worried about
once you take out the lambda.
No, that's
a non-local action. It's a
it's worse than a null collection. That's the
difference. Okay. So, are you worried about linear superposition?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a good reason why I'm not writing things like that.
I know you're worried about that. Right? Okay. So I'm gonna. So we can write this now manifestly locally. Now I'm not going to talk about that today because it's a secret, but but it's going to be out soon.
So, but is it that you're worried about?
Well, if you divide paths into two, that the amplitude for the whole path is not the product of the amplitude of the path. And I don't know what this path integral calculus.
Okay.
Normally, path integral calculus is Schrödinger wave function, solution of Schrödinger equation. So this object, okay, there's some.
So when you have a when you actually can be written in a manifestly local way, then this is guaranteed, right? Essentially. Okay, so now and we can do that now, but I'm not going to present it today. So
taking the
thing rules up. Now, even if you stare at this, which isn't quite actually, yeah, you would worry about it. I think it's a legitimate
because
thing to worry about.
All days when people were doing maybe universe or quantization, they were hidden kind of stuff like that, but they were saying, oh, you kind of measure those parameters and go to some super selection sector. And then you're left with...
Best thing I can say to you is wait and see, because we're going to write this in a local form. It'll be out. George, when's going to be out? A couple of weeks. So we can write it in a local form. Manifested local. But it has the same. There's a slight tweak to the model.
This is manifested in a local.
But I'm going to write it in a way that's manifested local. I can do that.
A freeway.
What?
So for instance, you said that if you move lambda in Jordan frame, let's say...
This is the final action.
Yeah, if you vary with respect to lambda, you get that the constraint on the average, all the space and average of R.
Yes.
Well, that's clearly a non-local constraint.
No, global. Let me call it global. Let's not use the word non-local.
Yeah,
global.
Well, global means non-local.
I like the way global better. I'm not disputing that. But I like the way global better. Right. Right. But... What has to ask, does this introduce any pathology? I think this is a legitimate thing to have worried about, but I think it's something that we can now answer by the fact that we can write this action in a local way. Well, again, at the moment we're just, at the moment we're just treating both gravity, the only thing that's being treated quantum mechanically at this stage are these matter fields. We're not treating, at the level of the path integral, but that would be asking about the quantum effects coming from the little lambda. I don't know the true answer to this at this stage. I mean, I'm not trying to do quantum gravity here. I'm thinking of the lambdas as being in the gravitational sector.
Well, the integral of the lambda is just normal integral, not path integral.
It is a normal integral, yes.
What the matter is, we'll get something a lot.
So it's not, right, okay, but if I can write in a manifestly local way, which I can. Yeah, we're going around in circles here. But if I can do that, then that's fine. Then the question is, does it introduce any pathology?
There is some local formulation in which you somehow still get the global constraint.
Yes.
Yeah.
Symmetry.
That's contradiction in terms.
No, it's symmetry. Symmetry.
Without
any of these Lagrangian. So by introducing more symmetry, you can. The theory, of course, classically will be. It's not quite identical to what I'm going to present today, but it's very similar. The cancellation mechanism is certainly the same.
You can't tell us. We won't tell anyone.
I'm banned from my collaborators from telling you. So I'm banned from telling you. Right? Those who know the manual know I'm right to be scared of revealing our secrets. So, but it,
you also calculate the measure path integral. It's just this action.
We're not talking about any path integrals at this stage. We're not talking about. We're not quantizing that sector of the theory. We're not thinking about that yet. It's purely classical. So I don't know how to answer. I don't know how to do quantum gravity. So I certainly don't know how to do quantum sequestered gravity. Right. Okay.
No,
so
if you don't quantize it, how do you know about loops and stability?
I'm not asking about graviton loops.
Okay.
I'm not asking. I'm only worrying about matter loops in a classical gravity theory.
My question is intrinsically quantum. Okay. You're not doing quantum.
Exactly.
What kind of objects you have in mind? What are you supposed to do with this action? usually we want to do path integral, right?
Right. Okay.
We cannot do it exactly in gravity, but it is.
So I guess in our local version, you would have some functional measure of the local fields. I mean, they're as ill-defined potentially as they are in general relativity. I mean, anything that suffers from, you know, they're going to have the same problems there as you do in general relativity. I mean, I can't even do it for general relativity straightforwardly, defining the measuring the path integral. So it's asking a lot to be able to do that as well. But certainly from the point of view of linear superposition, I don't think there should be an issue.
I think perturbation theory, low energies, GR is a perfectly
fine. This is a good point. So this is something we could start looking at. Absolutely, and we haven't yet. Okay, so at the moment, the only thing, we're just treating the matter sector as classical, as quantum, and everything else is classical. Okay, but yeah, and it's something that we need to ask about. Actually, it's fair enough, and you could do it like sort of as an perturbative expansion. I mean, it's tricky though.
Not exchanging something which is not even linear, the problem for working with objects which I have no idea what it was. What's not a failure problem? The cosmological problem. Not everybody in this room agrees that it's a real problem, and the problem is exchanging that issue for it doesn't change the fact that it's a problem.
So, but can we look? I don't even understand what is the model because I just
Okay, so tell us about the model.
So, right, good. Okay, so anyway, so you've introduced these two new global variables, okay? But you need to make them talk to each other. So, in a sense, this guy knows about the mass scales in the particle physics sector, in the matter sector. So, he knows about the vacuum energy. This guy's the countertone that you want to adjust. And they need to talk to each other. So we include this extra ingredient. Now this is going to come back to the same point. This lives outside of the integral. Of course it does, because its arguments are global. They're not fields, they're not local. Okay, so they're sitting outside the integral. This mu is just a mass scale introduced for dimensional analysis, dimensional reasons. And so you can now ask what the dynamics of this is. Okay, so of course, it's very locally it's identical to general relativity. So when you vary with respect to the metric, you just get what you would have got from general relativity. Here, this is just the T tilde is the energy momentum tension you would have got from the matter sector if you ignored the fact that the lambda was there. But of course, it's dimension 4, so it comes in with a lambda to the 4. But you can just call this combined object T. Okay. What's extra, what's additional to what you have in general relativity, of course, are the two global constraints. Okay, so you have these global constraints, of course, because you're varying over these global variables. And there they are what they are. Okay, and you can combine them. And when you combine the top two, it fixes what this global parameter lambda is. Okay, and it fixes it in a very particular way. It forces it to be a quarter of the space-time average of the trace of the energy momentum tensor in the matter sector. So now, you plug that back into the Lagrangian. So now, dynamically, you fix, through dynamics, you fix what the counter term should be.
You call it dynamics, but it's not really dynamics.
Yeah, I mean, what I mean is it comes from the variation of the action.
Okay, so
now, solving those equations.
So you solve the nationalist problem, but you've lost predictivity. Predictivity.
Well, you never have predictivity about the value of the
cosmological
constant.
Well, you need to know the future of T alpha alpha to be able to.
One number. It's one
number. Well, but that's that. The whole argument is about one number. So.
Right.
So, but I'm saying, so...
No, it's not that one, it's about the influence of the higher loop correction.
But I'm saying, so that you saw that, and I mean, okay, I guess somebody might argue that maybe you haven't done that, but I'm saying, you saw that, but you lost predictivity.
You never had predictivity about what the cosmological constant was anyway. Not without complete knowledge of the full UV theory, which we simply don't have.
Well, why isn't that equivalent to just saying, according to future boundary conditions, that the Ricci scalar should be zero? Mm-hmm. That's the argument.
But that, again, that always
that's
has to be...
as a causal as what you're doing.
That, there's no, okay, so there's no local violation of causality. This, I think, is a fair. It's just there's an imposition of a future boundary condition. This is nothing new in general relativity.
This is something you do the moment you define a black hole event horizon. You impose a future boundary condition when you
no,
do
I'm
that.
Just saying I just did that, right? I just put a future.
Okay, so what we're doing is we're doing it in such a way that guarantees that the influence of those loops, no matter to what order you introduce them, goes away. What theory is it that you've done that does that?
I just told you, it's 10 VR, no lambdas being carried over. I just put a future boundary condition that R should go to zero.
The R should go to zero, asymptotic.
Yeah. Yeah, perfect theory. Solve the CC problem.
So what's the, we'll write down the theory.
Oh, no, yeah, I just told you. I don't have to stare at it for half an hour. I just told you.
Also, I don't understand how this solves anything, right? Because you can very easily have a model, a landscape made of two vacua, a metastable vacuum,
okay,
the one where we are living now, and the one where the universe will end forever afterwards. That average will be sensitive only what the universe will be tunneling through in a trillion years, but
right,
it won't tell what is the.
So this is an interesting question: the influence of metastable vacuum. So. This is something that we, right, so firstly we can ask what happens with phase transitions, which is a kind of subtly similar question, but not quite the same. The influence of metastable vacua. So we think that what you would do there is, it's whatever the vacuum, the what's defined as the, what this theory would see as the sort of bottom line, zero point energy, is the final vacuum state of the universe. So that's how the cancellations would work. So if it tunnels, if the universe tunnels to some state, some lower energy configuration, that would be the one that it would cancel relative to.
Which is not necessarily ours, because I mean you
But then you can ask what the influence of phase transitions, essentially the same question. And what you find is that because everything gets suppressed by the total volume of the universe, that the influence is small.
Yeah, I'm not talking about that. I'm simply saying the TMU average on our vacuum for, say, a mere trillion years, right, and over a billion Hubble patches may not be that vacuum average, right? Because, I mean, typically, actually, in what you expect from string theory is to have maybe metastable the sitter vacuum that then eventually will tunnel to some supersymmetric vacuum with zero cosmological constant. So the universe will be forever in that boring state, but
so like
we don't.
So like I say, I'm not certain of the answer to this question, but I think that the correct answer would be that the one that you would measure, the one that the cancellation is done relative to, is the one at the final state.
So not necessarily ours.
But then I'm just telling you that the net effect, there is some cancellation, but it's even in ours, it's just not exact as it would. It's not as exact as it would be in the final one. And what you find is that there is an overall suppression factor coming from the total age of the universe. So in a large and old universe, which ours already is, there's always all these effects are going to be suppressed. And you can see that, as I said, by looking at this is something that I accept that we need to look at more closely, but that's the intuition at this stage. Okay, so anyway, let me proceed. So what this does is it zooms in on and cancelling off the global components of the energy momentum sensor. So you split it up into your vacuum energy contribution calculated, however you'd like to calculate it, be it to one loop, two loop, three loop, whatever. Doesn't matter. And then local excitations. Okay, now what's key about this is that when you take the space-time average of a constant, it is that constant. Okay, so it gets canceled. You feed it back in and you realize it doesn't appear in the equation at all. It just drops out entirely. Therein lies the cancellation mechanism. Okay, and as I said, it works to any order in loops. Each and every order. There are no hidden equations. It's not like unimodular gravity. This is it. There are no hidden equations in there. This is all you get. But you do get a residual cosmological constant, which just knows about the, remember, these guys are just the excitations. Okay? And you can estimate how big that is in a large and old universe. The point is that this guy has absolutely nothing to do with vacuum energy, just knows about the excitations. And this is the thing that you would think about fixing empirically. Okay, so how big is it? Well, you can estimate how big it is. One thing I haven't told you, which is true in this theory, but I haven't explained why, and I will do in a bit, is that it turns out that the universe can't be infinite. It can't have infinite space-time volume. It turns out that particle masses would go to zero in that limit. So we have a universe with finite space-time volume. So it must be something that sort of grows and then crunches. Okay? And you can, in that scenario, you can calculate, you can estimate how big this lambda effective is. It turns out that those integrals that are involved there are dominated by the point at which the universe is largest. Okay? So that means that this space-time average is roughly the energy density of the universe at its largest point. Now, of course, we're still in the expanding phase, so that's going to be lower than the energy critical density of the universe now. So this can't be dark energy. This is naturally small in a large and old universe. So it can't be dark energy, but that's okay. It's small. So that's a good consistency check. So what are the main observational consequences? Well, like I said, we have that the universe should end. It should have finite space-time volume. Why should that happen? Well, it came from one of the equations of motion. I sort of screwed up a little bit there, but remember, these little lambdas essentially tell you about the particle masses. So as little lambda, the physical masses go like lambda times the mass term that would appear in the Lagrangian. Okay, so if little lambda goes to zero, that's sending your particle masses to zero. Okay, so if you had infinite volume, it should be d4x there, obviously. If you had infinite volume and sigma was, just take sigma to be a linear function here, so sigma prime is 1 just for simplicity. Then if you have infinite volume, that's forcing little lambda to go to 0, which would send your particle masses to 0, and that's obviously not our universe.
Sorry, Tony, I'm slightly confused. Is that a dynamical statement, or is that statement about all of
all
the volume?
This, remember, little lambda is a constant in space-time.
Okay, so this knows
so
about...
just the statement that particle masses aren't zero in our universe maps in this theory to the statement that the universe should have finite space-time volume.
Sorry, but then I don't understand your answer to Kurt's question, because that's usually the relationship you have if lambda is really coupled with a dilaton, which has to take into account how matter fields transform under dilations, but you didn't do that.
So this is a constant.
Yeah, but I'm saying, even for constant dilaton, I'm saying, in order to have generic relationships between masses like that, you need to take into account the conformal weight of matter fields. Whereas you didn't do that.
So remember what little lambda does is, little lambda is a constant rescaling of the metric that couples to matter. So it just rescales all mass scales.
Sorry, now I'm confused. So maybe
you're
right.
I'm confused
now.
Okay.
Sorry. So, given you didn't tell us how to do quantum theory for lambda, how do I know that this end of the universe will happen classically or not? Just we live in our accelerating universe, and like a minute from now, it will end.
That's a fair point. I don't think I can answer that. All right. So, modulo that point. You certainly can imagine a scenario where this which would be compatible with this, which is in which the universe ends in a crunch. It would certainly demand, and I think this is consistent with that the phase of dark energy being have an equation state -1 can only be transient, because of course if it's eternally de Sitter, that would drive all my particle masses to zero. Also, it's not obvious from this, but there is also, it turns out that you need to have spherical spatial sections. It's not obvious why that is, but it's true. And you can look for evidence of that, circles in the sky. We also see a possible correlation between the equation of state and the omega k. So these are the kind of things that you can look for. Have I got time to talk about this? This is sort of how the universe should end.
Is there an easy way to say why you need positive for curved spatial sections?
It's because there's an additional, basically this is GR plus constraint, right? And that constraint seems to imply some topological constraint on the spatial sections when you look at FRW universes. It's technical, but it's
so not,
it comes from
not something like finite volume. It's just that
no, it comes
really from a topological.
It comes from actually zooming in and looking at what the constraint gives you, and it seems to imply some sort of topological constraint on the spatial section in FRW. Okay, so we want something to end.
Torus
would violate this. We didn't realize this at first, but it turns out, if you have a toroidal universe, you can't satisfy the constraint in an FRW universe.
It's not topological, it's geometric.
Yeah.
And you're not.
The truth is that we don't really know what it is. We don't really understand in detail what. But it's coming from the constraint, the additional constraints in the theory. Okay. So. You know the universe has to end. You know that dark energy can't be a pure cosmological constant here. So you link the two in a neat way. Okay, so we sort of started looking at this, and we thought of what model could you have that could give you dark energy with equation state different from -1 and also collapse the universe for you. Well, it's a very simple model, and it's kind of the most natural, well, a natural model of dark energy, which is that of a linear potential. Okay, this is a very nice model, quintessence model, basically because the form of this potential and the size of the coefficient, these are all technically natural. Okay, the form is protected by shift symmetry, the size is technically natural. This is a nice, very nicely well-behaved potential. And so it has obviously two important ingredients in that it can collapse the universe because as the scalar rolls to negative values, it gives you the required negative energy to collapse the universe. But it can also give you slow roll. It doesn't have to give you slow roll, but it can give you slow roll. It depends on the initial conditions for phi. At least that's true in general relativity. If the initial value of phi is super Planckian, when the scalar dominates, it does slow roll until the collapse occurs at this time. That's also true if you embed this linear potential in general relativity. But there is a difference here. Okay. When the collapse happens, well, you can choose that in a because that's depends on radiatively stable parameters. So you can choose, and that happens in a radiatively stable way. What about the initial value of phi? That's also you can choose in our setup, what was a pseudo-symmetry in general relativity now becomes a true symmetry. And that means that that yes, you can choose the initial value of phi in a radiatively stable way in contrast to general relativity, but it's actually better than that. It turns out that the global constraint that you have in addition in the sequestering scenario, namely that the space-time average of the Ricci scalar is zero, picks out precisely those solutions and only those solutions for which the initial value of phi is just super Planckian. So it guarantees that when the scalar does dominate, it does slow roll. So it kind of gives you a new angle on the why now scenario. So why now? Because the end is nigh. And why is it nigh? Well, because you can choose that radiatively stable parameter to coincide with the fact that the universe is going to end soon. And we also have an additional prediction, which is that the equation of state for dark energy is correlated to omega k in this case. Okay, so there's a bunch of stuff I haven't had time to talk about. Symmetries, obviously, it's a symmetry at work here. Phase transitions, we've talked a little bit about. Inflation, loads of other things. There are some things that I don't consider an issue, which we have sort of touched on. Have you fine-tuned lambda effective? Not really. Loops are gone. That's the issue. The thing that you really worry about are loops. They're gone, so that's not the problem. A causality we touched on. I think that if you want to do something like this, there has to be some degree of acausality. The question is it an amount which you can swallow comfortably? Why does it have to be? Because, again, this notion that if you truly want to measure the vacuum energy, you really have to scan the whole of space-time.
So I just want to object to that especially about vacuum energy is that a question of a state of -1. So, and that's something that you can measure locally. So you don't have to just wait forever.
Exactly.
You don't have to wait forever.
But you have to know it to all orders in a you know, you have to know that it's W equals minus one exactly, and that essentially.
No, I mean if it's approximately minus one and you subtract it, that's fine. Yeah.
Well, if it's approximately minus one, you don't know that what you're talking about is a true value.
But anytime, so it's just never something that has W or very close to minus one.
You have to know it's exactly minus one, and to do that, you've got to know the equation of state and all its derivatives exactly.
No, but
essentially
no. But I'm saying you don't need that.
To know that it's genuinely a cosmological constant, dark energy, mm-hmm. Yes, you do.
But I don't care. I mean, I can kill everything as W less than minus 0.9, let's say, or something.
Fine. But the thing.
Minus 0.9.
But the thing that's bothering you, the thing that's giving you those loop crashes that are annoying you, that are causing the problem, that corresponds to the thing that has genuinely equation state exactly minus.
Sure, but I kill that.
That's what I'm
worried about. Other things possible.
That's what I'm worried about. To know what that is, I would have to scan the whole space.
But I'm saying that you could kill that and some other things. But I'm saying, so if I...
Right. So you're saying I could... Right, fine.
You're setting...
Fine. Okay, so you could... Right. Good point. Okay. Okay. But then what you're saying is that not only am I going to just... So to do that, you would have to modify not gravity just globally, but also slightly in the infrared as well.
Yes.
Okay.
Now,
what's that going to do to short distance physics? Then you have to start worrying about what other impact that can have on short distance physics and your gravity theory.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's like the honest way of doing it, as opposed to waiting for
infinity. Well, I mean, but then you have to ask yourself, what kind of pathology does it actually introduce?
Well, I mean,
doesn't introduce any closed time like curves, nothing like that.
Yeah.
So it's just. It's essentially you're fixing one number.
Well,
it's a global. You're basically modifying general relativity with a global constraint.
So we're linked to Descartes Hilbert, so maybe we can let Tony
say something. Okay. So yeah. Well, let me just leave the summary up on the board and.